What you know about layer 1 D5, greatest in the world, and they finally about to see why. What you know about XRD, I'm smart money, I ain't never on a decline. What you know about NFTs, it's not just ace, when you finally gonna realize. You need scalability, need more utility, then you better call on these guys. I'm going radical, I'm going radish, I'm going radical, I'm going radish. Hyperspeed D5, never on a decline, building the future, I feel like a savage.
Hello and welcome. I am Piers Ridyard, CEO of RDX Works, a core developer of the decentralized finance protocol Radix, a public ledger entirely focused on bringing DeFi into the mainstream. This is our podcast, the DeFi Download, a show about decentralized finance and all things crypto, where we dive into the details of the projects, assets, and services that are powering the DeFi revolution. Today, I'm joined by Professor Campbell Harvey, Professor of Finance at Duke University and co-author of DeFi and the Future of Finance. Cam, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, really interesting background that you've got. It would be great to understand it, sort of how you got to be a professor of finance and writing a book around DeFi and the future of finance.
Don't see one by life history. I'll be very brief on this. The way that I got interested in kind of academic or research in finance is, it was totally unexpected to me. I was doing a master's. I had no expectation of doing a PhD, but I had a summer job and I was put in charge of developing a forecasting model for GDP growth by the largest copper miner in the world at the time. And I had this intuition, instead of looking at all the macro data, why not look at financial data that already includes expectations of the future?
Right.
So during that internship, I got this idea of using the slope of the yield curve. So the difference between a long-term yield and a short-term yield. And it worked really well. It made sense. And I got back for my second year of the master's and showed it to my professors. They said, you need to apply for a PhD. And that's exactly what happened. I applied, and my family had no idea what I was doing. So what's a PhD? You know, another couple of years or 1 year? So my application included the research paper. And now I realize that's the ideal application for kind of a research position to show that you can do it. So that's how I started out. So I'm the guy that people refer to when the yield curve inverts, which means that the short rate is higher than the long rate. It doesn't happen that often, but it happens before recessions. So that's my start. Now, the second issue is, well, what about decentralized finance? How did I get interested in that? Well, I've got a long history. I do academic work, but I also do outside work. And one of the ventures I was involved with, and this goes back to the year 2000 and 2001. So my partner and I had this idea. And the idea was that, let's say you're a company and at the end of September, you need 100 million euros. Okay, so you've got dollars and you need to get into the euros. So you call your friendly investment bank and they will quote you a rate on that. So, and then there's another customer of the same bank that actually needs to unload 100 million euros at the end of September. And they call the bank and they get a price. And it's a different price. And the bank makes the spread.
Right.
So, and it's a very profitable idea. And it's been going on for years. But what we pitched was a different system whereby with our software, we would put together those two customers in a peer-to-peer way. And then eliminate the spread. We would pay a small fee to the investment bank because they're handling all the credit arrangements and checking out the customer. But it would be vastly less profitable for the bank to actually do this. And then we noticed that some of these companies have multiple relationships with different banks, and this created a network effect. So it is a very elegant idea. It's a purely decentralized finance idea. And we were in the position of pitching to these banks this idea. And basically, it goes like this. Pay us a lot of money to implement a system that will reduce your profitability.
Right.
And it's a tough, tough pitch.
Right.
But nevertheless, like,
that sounds great.
Some banks actually kind of realized that this business is not sustainable. And maybe it's best that we get in early with this new idea and be the first in. So that's a long time. That's 22 years. And then my most recent interest, and again, it's an interesting story. I didn't teach for 7 years, from 2006 until 2013, because I was editing the top journal in my field, the Journal of Finance. So I decided to go back to my asset management course. And you probably, everybody listening or watching this, knows the story. You've seen it before. The professor goes to the classroom and drops these slides in that are like a decade old.
Right.
And I didn't want to be that professor. So I hadn't taught the course in 7 years. I scrapped everything and decided to start afresh in 2013. And I usually do a module on FX. So study whatever the euro, the yen, the pound. And I'm thinking, well, why not add something new? This Bitcoin idea. So that's kind of where it started. So I jumped in. I read the Satoshi Nakamoto paper. Mm-hmm. First time I read it, yeah, okay. And then I read it again. And then I realized, oh, this is really big idea, really a big idea. Mm. And I jumped in, and though I published in computer science before, I'm not a computer scientist. I haven't studied in great detail cryptography and stuff like that. So to get up to speed was enormously difficult. And what I was going to do was simply a lecture. And it took, I have 12 lectures in my course, each 2 hours and 15 minutes. And this one lecture on cryptocurrency took far more time to prepare than the sum of the other 11.
Right.
So I get it organized. I do the lecture. And again, think back to your time in college. When it comes to the hour, people just get up and leave.
Right.
And there's no tolerance for going late. So I had a packed room, and I did the crypto lecture. And then I finished, and people just sitting there. And I'm thinking, I'm messed up. I must have like ended early. And I look up at the clock, and it's exactly at the hour. And people just like sitting there. And it was really weird to me. And then my second thought is, I must have really bombed this lecture. It must be terrible. And then some people came to the front of the class and said that this was a transformational lecture, unlike anything they've ever had. And this was just not one person. This was a large number of people. And this never happened to me before. And they said, this needs to be a full course, at least. And that's where I started in 2014. In terms of this journey. So yes, I've got this book, DeFi and the Future of Finance, and many of the people writing books in this space, they're new to this. And they read a bit here or there, and it's obvious sometimes that there's only a superficial understanding.
Right.
So I've invested a lot of time. And one of the most important things that I teach my students is to know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important quality as an academic. So if you do great disservice to your students and to yourself by mouthing off about stuff that you really don't know. And so again, this has taken a lot of time. And as you know, the depreciation of this material is very large. So right. For example, when
crypto
I talked
this quickly.
Year, yeah, this year, the slides that I had were fresh.
Right.
Like everything turned over from the right. year before. And right. and for this coming year, probably 50%. So you have to constantly invest.
Right.
Yeah, so that's my story. It is, you know, I've got a history in finance. I've done research in many different areas of finance. I've been fortunate to be editor of the Journal of Finance. So I see all different strands of research. This one completely under the radar for the academics, and yeah. And this is important for me. I want to give my students a vision of the future, and that's really important for them when they're making their career choices and their life choices.
So, what year was this? What year was this first lecture, the one that was so impactful that sort of got you into?
Yeah, 2014.
2014.
In the spring of 2014, yeah.
And have you tracked many of the careers of your students from that year and what they've subsequently done? It'd be really interesting to know sort of how the trajectory has been and how many of them decided to go into the crypto space.
Yeah, so this is the thing that at the time, not so easy to go into crypto.
Right.
So many of my students went to, let's say, consulting firms, mm-hmm. like, for example, Deloitte, which mm-hmm. had like a blockchain practice. They were one mm-hmm. of the earliest ones. And then from there, they like went out on their own and, right. you know, founded firms and stuff like that. So yeah, the Duke alumni are pretty significant, and not just for what I teach, but the undergrad has produced like a lot of stars in this space. Duke has been a leader in many different areas. So one is the teaching. Number two, our alumni have done well. And then number three, our endowment has been very aggressive investing right. in the space over the years. So, and has been kind of a model for other universities. So,
that's really fascinating. Yeah. So like, I'm going to ask you a question, a deceptively simple question with a potentially complex answer, especially for a professor of finance. What is the point of the financial system?
Yes. Okay. So that is kind of like, what is the meaning of life? So it is a simple question, but what do we really want?
Right.
So that you need to take a step back. So what do we really want? And I think that we want to be well off. We don't want people in poverty. So we want to have kind of a vibrant society where people are well off, where people can do what they want to do. And if they've got an idea, then they're able to pursue that idea. So, and the way to do that is to have resources available in an efficient way. So, markets are created for that. And when markets actually began, and this is kind of interesting, my book begins with the line, we have come full circle. And what I mean by that is the earliest market economies were barter.
Right.
And barter is fundamentally a peer-to-peer technology.
Right.
But it was very, very inefficient. You had mm-hmm. to do an exact match and physically match. So then markets developed with money, which made this much more efficient
right.
in terms of exchange. But along with that came market power. And today, there's enormous market power by the commercial banks, the central banks, the exchanges, the insurance companies. Just think about exchanges for a minute. That when you go public, you need to choose an exchange. Is it NASDAQ or is it NYSE? And that's it. And they get a monopoly. Right. So it's just like market power. And all of these, the concentration, the market power, what that does is effectively increase the cost of transacting. So remember I said when we had barter, well, that's very costly, very inefficient. Then money made it more efficient. But there's limitations, the concentration, centralization, and this introduces increased transactions costs. And when you've got all of these frictions, it's going to cost you in terms of economic growth. Now, let me give you an example of this. And I use this example in my book that we know that there's 1.7 billion people unbanked in the world. But there isn't a very good estimate of the number that are underbanked.
Right.
And right. And the example I give is somebody is an entrepreneur that's got a great idea, a fabulous return on investment, needs to finance the project. And this person banked. And they go to the bank, and the banker likes the idea. Says, oh, it's a really good idea. Mm. But we would rather deal with one large customer rather than 100 customers like you.
Right.
But given that you're a customer of the bank, you've got a credit card, what we'll do is increase the limit on your credit card. You can borrow on your credit card and finance the project. And we know what the rate is for borrowing on a credit card. It's so punitive that the project isn't pursued. Now, that is a microcosm of the issue. The big issue here is that's a friction. It should be that if you've got a good idea, it is financed and it doesn't matter how big you actually are. And the current system has got this wedge in there. And the project that this person was presenting, those are the types of projects we actually need to pursue in our economy. We're stuck in 2% real GDP growth or 1% real GDP growth. Last quarters were negative GDP growth. So we're stuck in this very low growth mode. And it is a direct result. And my academic research is very much related to this. It's a direct result of the frictions and the transactions costs in our current system. If you reduce those frictions, and decentralized finance has the opportunity of doing this, then that project would go ahead. We get many projects like that that would increase investment, that would increase employment, and it would increase real GDP growth. We need to bump the GDP growth very substantially. Indeed, there's another reason to bump the growth, and that is the size of the government debt. So in the U.S., it's 100% of GDP. And in the early 1980s, because we're always talking about 40 years ago, it was 30%. So how do you pay that off? And there's three ways to pay it off. Increase taxes, and no politician wants to do that. It's it's a recipe for defeat at the polls. And number two is to print money or inflate.
Right.
And that's just another tax. And number three is to grow.
Right.
So decentralized finance gives us the opportunity to basically, you know, the vision is financial inclusion, financial democracy, and everybody's a peer. So it's no client and banker, retail investor, institutional investor. Everybody's a peer.
Right.
And that holds the promise of reducing frictions, making our financial system much more efficient, and that allows us to grow and allows us to get close to the objective where people are well off, can do what they want to do, pursue the ideas that they want to pursue. So this is a means to the end.
Yeah. So I think there's a few questions here. There's, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for the reducing the unit cost of service, right? Like the ability to make systems more automated and more efficient so that you can, as a platform, as an application, decide to lend to thousands of borrowers, small borrowers, rather than one big borrower, just because of the infrastructure that exists within banks to be able to service that. Like if the value of the loan isn't over a certain amount, it's not cost effective for them, even on the returns, right? Which is why they'll do the credit card thing, which then breaks your sort of ROI of the potential investment that the entrepreneur wants to make. And therefore that doesn't happen. And you're not actually stimulating growth, as you say. However, what is it that you see as unique about DeFi's ability to do that versus, you know, this idea that you had, 20 years ago when you were doing peer-to-peer matching using a digital platform of FX swaps? You know, like why is this different? Why is this application of technology different from just doing it in a digital services approach?
Yeah, so it's really simple. DeFi is peer-to-peer. There's no middle person. There's an algorithm. That's it. So, and think of what we have right now. We've got like a centralized financial system, and our banks are being attacked right now with the recent wave of fintech. So a speaker in my course made the statement that the current wave of fintech is like putting lipstick on a pig. Mm-hmm. And basically what the speaker was saying was, well, the current wave is positive, right? Because mm-hmm. it actually reduces costs for mm-hmm. consumers, and that's good. But mm-hmm. given the current wave uses the centralized infrastructure, it can mm-hmm. only reduce costs to a certain degree. Then right. you hit the barrier of the centralized infrastructure. So DeFi is completely different. It doesn't use the centralized infrastructure. It's not like a renovation. So think of fintech as a renovation of our current financial system, whereas DeFi is a complete rebuild from the bottom up. So a good example is like decentralized exchange. Mm-hmm. So yeah. If you think about how it works in the traditional way to do exchange, I want to buy something from, let's say, a broker yeah. Who's a middle person in the exchange. I need yeah. to get money to that broker. Wire mm-hmm. transfer could be a couple of days, 2 to 5 yep. days. Then I do it. Then the broker basically, let's say, buys the stock. It's going to be another 2 days before they settle that transaction. You know, all yep. these delays are on purpose. Right. The technology right. is there to make it much more efficient, but it's all on purpose because somebody's making money off of this. Right. So it's really right. super inefficient. Where is in decentralized exchange, I connect my wallet, I'm ready to go, and there's an algorithm out there. I can see yep. the liquidity in the algorithm, yep. send asset A to it, I get asset B. The algorithm doesn't care if I'm a buyer or a seller. The algorithm's available 24/7. Yep. It's liquid in terms of whatever's in the pool, so it doesn't matter yep. when you're actually trading. And look, it's not too hard to imagine that in the future, we'll be dealing with algorithms.
Sure.
So not just
I think that feels inevitable. Like there's so much about how finance operates today that just feels completely jarring based on our experience of the internet otherwise, right? The internet is a peer-to-peer network of services providers and users where you can connect to anything you want and choose what you want, right?
The internet today is pretty centralized. So, for example, DNS is centralized.
Sure, but that doesn't actually create a huge amount of inefficiencies or frictions from the point of view of me setting up a website, creating a business on the internet, being an entrepreneur on the internet, or indeed being a user of the internet on the other side. My DNS service provider is not introducing fees and charges to me to make it difficult or impossible for me to be able to access the things I want to. So I do agree there's some structural inefficiencies in the internet. The internet itself, I actually, from a protocol point of view, it is a decentralized protocol. From the way in which routing algorithms are done, like DNS service provider, DNS and things like that, yes, there's a bunch of problems. And also around, I know in America, there's sort of the, there's a lot of questions and debate around, I can't remember what it's called, net neutrality, that's right. About, you know, the ability of service providers to differentially charge for different types of traffic. So there's definitely some battles bring there. I don't disagree with it. But from a consumer perspective, that can feel, that feels very open from all of the things that I could do. Whereas from a finance perspective, you constantly feel like you're battling against forms, against inefficiencies, against bureaucracy, against fees, against like time to for things to clear. And I do think, I think, you know, I often think about DeFi as, you know, finance for the internet age. It's like it is now something that isn't going, let's recreate this. So internet 1.0 was building things that we already knew in the real world on the web. So you went, okay, well, yeah, so I normally
web pamphlets. 1.0 is basically something like Wikipedia or the New York Times, a replica of like an encyclopedia or the actual physical newspaper. And then we go to web 2, which is more community-based, social media, and things like that. And then what's missing is something that actually the developers of the World Wide Web actually thought was just a given. And that was the ability to use these browsers for transactions. There was a lot of research in the early 1980s and mid-1980s about digital currency. And almost all those initiatives failed. And it wasn't until the 2008 paper by Satoshi Nakamoto that we kind of solved that problem. And then this allows for Web3. So DeFi is, well, a necessary condition for Web3. It allows us to actually pay or be paid in a very efficient way. And this is opening up just a huge amount of opportunity. So you're right. This completes the internet. So there was a like a big hole in what we've had for a very long time. Or if I wanted to pay for something, you need to put a credit card in. And then that's a 300 basis point fee right there. Or you put your bank coordinates in. And who wants to do that? So this is very – I think that some people just focus on DeFi and they don't realize that without DeFi, there's no Web3.
Yeah. The basis of this entire thing is the concept of ownership and ability to transfer ownership. And like Web3, you know, the underpinning of that, whether or not you're looking at NFTs or you're looking at lending markets or you're looking at gaming, it's all about sovereign ownership of digital objects. And like without DeFi, you don't have that. Without these like building blocks that have been built. I think that the other thing that, you know, you're talking about DEXs, right? Decentralized exchanges. The other thing that Web3 is doing that I think is incredibly powerful is creating liquidity around long tail assets. So you talk about like primary issuance. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to be able to invest, I guess, an investment in an instrument. I want to be invested in so I can then go and like build my company and I need to be able to get the right funding rate. The secondary thing that happens is because of this, these barriers and these frictions, only the big companies end up being the traded entities, end up having the liquidity. But now you have DEXs and communities where communities can, without needing a professional background, go and provide liquidity to liquidity pools, which can in turn make sure that that asset that's been issued that previously in the traditional financial sector wouldn't even be given the time of day of an exchange now has the opportunity to be liquid enough to be a real instrument that is tradable on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so this is a great point that you're making. That if you think of, let's say, an IPO for a company, that is that's only for the bigger companies to get to that stage. So before that, you have to rely upon bank financing, which is carries a very high interest rate, or venture financing, which is effectively a very high rate of return. So the venture capitalists, they're not looking for 10%. They're looking for 10x.
Right.
So that means you need to basically sell your equity to these venture capitalists at a deep discount. So it's enormous. So you, I said that the bank financing is expensive. This is way more expensive. So there is the possibility with tokenization that basically any firm can issue equity. And indeed, there are ventures that are trying to liquefy private equity. So when I say private equity, it's not the traditional sense. What I mean is the equity of a firm that's private.
Small cap companies that are not public.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, I think, a really important channel that I gave you the example of the entrepreneur going to the bank and the very high cost of that financing. Well, that's just routine today. That if you go and issue your equity, it's a deep discount to get money from private investors. So DeFi opens the door for anybody with a good idea to get some financing. Of course, there's regulatory issues because many of these investments are clearly securities. But right now, there's
I actually think there's a good path forwards in America for this. You guys have got the Jobs Act. I think if the Jobs Act is extended to include the ability to raise financing within similar bounded conditions as the Jobs Act provides for crowdfunding, I don't see why it's not possible to create a regulatory regime around sort of funding via these things that is not overly onerous. But I'm curious because you were talking recently, you gave a talk to the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is the guys who are responsible for implementing the Biden executive order. Like, what is the current temperature of the government around regulation and crypto and their view to like whether or not it's a threat versus an opportunity and how the sort of politicians are actually reacting to this?
So one thing that's unfortunate is that when there is an exploit, it gets a disproportionate amount of media attention. So right now, I think the regulators realize that there has to be some guidance. The U.S. is so complicated. There's at least five different agencies that are claiming that they should be the ones that are regulating. Right. So it's chaos right now.
Right.
And right now, I think that the regulators realize, and this is part of my remarks to the FSOC, the Treasury's oversight board, was that you need to find the balancing point. So if you're too harsh in the regulations, given this is a global technology, the innovations just move offshore.
Right.
And it's very easy to do that today because it's all digital. But if you're too lax, then people will be taken advantage of. Right. And the Securities Act of 1933 in the U.S. was designed to protect consumers from being exploited.
Right.
So those are the two extremes, and you need to find the middle. And as I said, you need to keep in mind what all of the problems that are being solved potentially with this technology and the benefit of getting on a much steeper growth path, that needs to be weighed against the costs. And I also told them that the strategy of reducing all the risk, well, we know how to do that. Just invest in treasury bills.
Right.
And we know what the return, the expected return on treasury bills are.
Right.
So I think that risk is okay.
Yeah.
And obviously, people need to be diversified. So somebody taking their life savings and betting on a single cryptocurrency, well, that's just not wise investment. And it doesn't matter if it's cryptocurrency or just a penny stock. We just don't do that. So you need to have a diversified approach. But I do worry because this is so challenging for the regulator for many reasons. So one reason is that this is a complex space and they need to put the time in to actually understand the space. And I know how costly that is for my teaching.
Right.
I need to constantly invest. And then kind of related to that is you have to realize the depreciation is quite rapid. You need to continually invest. And then number three is just hard to hire people into these regulatory agencies that are experts in the space because the experts have many other opportunities that are much higher paying than working for a government agency. So a very, very challenging problem. And from my interaction with regulators, I know they want to do the right thing. And it's just really difficult to get that balancing point. I've advocated basically stepping back and taking 3 or 4 years to develop a unified system. So a single regulator for all of this. So we don't have five, and there might be a new regulator also, and then give safe harbor until the new laws are actually put in.
Right.
The last thing I'll mention is that even though I'm talking to the U.S., and the U.S. is obviously a very important jurisdiction in terms of crypto, given that most of the activity happens in the U.S., this is a global platform. So you can have regulations in one country, and ideally they're coordinated across other countries, but it's so difficult to do.
So difficult. Though, you know, like things like MiCA, things like FATFA, all those, like there's definitely appetite for global coordination. And it does seem to be coming in some ways, but you know, like the way in which VASPs have actually been implemented globally does differ quite drastically jurisdiction to jurisdiction in terms of what information has to be shared between the different asset service providers and like what has to be collected and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, it does feel like a danger of all of the stuff that we're talking about in the traditional financial system, all of those like friction points and difficulties and intermediaries and ways in which friction is introduced to the system ends up getting introduced essentially by mistake because of there's not a unified or coordinated approach. And unlike the internet, because we're dealing with money and because it's core from a strategic point of view, from an economic point of view to governments, and because when people lose money, they complain a lot more hard than if, you know, they lose something like they wasted time on an internet, you know, forum arguing with someone. Like, I think that all of the problems we already have with the internet and the difficulty in governing the internet, we're going to see tenfold in this space just because of how central finance is to everything.
There's another issue here. And that is, if you look at the regulatory actions, they're exclusively against centralized companies.
Right.
So, you know, Coinbase gets served a Wells notice. Coinbase also is recently there's issues, but
we
hear about Celsius, Three Arrows Capital, Voyager. All these are centralized firms,
right?
So think about the regulatory dilemma here. That was easy to go against these centralized firms, but in DeFi, what do you do? The example of the decentralized exchange?
Yeah.
Well, that's just an algorithm.
Right.
Right. So, like, how do you serve an algorithm?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense. So, right. And look, to declare some of these things securities when they're decentralized, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I recently went through the Securities Act of 1933. It's actually not a long read. But one thing that was hilarious to me was that once you're declared the security, you need to have a transfer agent.
Right.
Yeah. And it says that explicitly. What is a transfer agent
in
the world of decentralized finance? Right. It makes no sense whatsoever. You know, this act was written in a different era, like a non-digital era. Right. So I do think that we need some sort of guidance. And indeed, just the uncertainty that's being created as to what might happen is driving innovation offshore.
Yeah.
So you want to keep your best ideas. If you're in the U.S., you want to keep them in the U.S. In the U.K., you want to keep them in the U.K. It's kind of a natural thing that you kind of invest in your people, their education, and you want to benefit from that. But instead, there's this option of just fleeing.
Yeah, and I think that the I do think that it is like I don't know how much it can all go offshore indefinitely. Just because if it is going to incorporate the entire global financial system, it has to be local to people within jurisdictions, right? And there are always going to be people who are going to be trying to capture users, be them wallets or exchanges or whatever. But, you know, someone made an amazing point. I was talking at the DeFi summit in Jersey sort of a few weeks ago, and someone said, look at the way that we regulate gambling. We don't, and this goes along your risk point. And I know that it's a little bit left field, right? Because we always think of investing as serious and risk-based approach and all this kind of stuff. But in gambling, we have a set of rules around making sure that we don't encourage people to, you know, gamble away their life savings and to make sure that they are prudential in how they do that. But we accept as a society that people can put some money on a roulette table and never see it. And that's fine. That's sort of like an okay framework. I think that the thing where it becomes very gray is where it's the difference between how much risk are you being upfront about in what you're actually doing as a consumer? And what do you understand as the likelihood of loss? And as long as those things, I think it's going to be consistent regulation and guidelines around that, around the communication of these instruments, rather than necessarily around registration, transfer agents and stuff like that. That feels less helpful, especially when, because this is a global industry and the way the SEC tends to seem to think its enforcement works, as in how it does enforce, is it claims jurisdiction over anything internationally that touches a US citizen, which ends up people actually excluding the US entirely. So,
I'm just not convinced in the future that we'll have the same model of regulation. So I agree with you. Ideally, you've got transparency, you've got lots of information. Somebody's offering a new coin, for example, a new protocol, and you want to know all the details. But you look at the white paper and you're not equipped to evaluate it as kind of the average investor. So traditionally, we just rely upon the regulator for this, and it just introduces all these costs. Right. So my vision of the future is that there's kind of decentralized regulation through reputation.
Right.
So there will be decentralized protocols that effectively their job is to evaluate, to assign reputation. And people will use those to guide and to avoid kind of the obvious scams, like the squid coin. So the squid coin is a great example. It goes from zero to, $2,200. And in real time, people are saying, oh, this can't be right, because the website is a joke. The white paper is just filled with errors, is promoted with fake Elon Musk tweets. Like, it's really obvious. When Musk sends a tweet out with the blue check mark, but no. And then the Telegram account, the comments are disabled. You know, there's just multiple red flags, people saying in real time as the price is going to 2,000. Think of a different model where people put some work in and they get rewarded, and then there's kind of a reputation score that is assigned for a product like that. And the score would be zero for the Squid Coin in real time. So a lot of this stuff can be avoided. Do we need to rely upon the regulator? Probably not. They cannot operate in real time.
Right.
And so I think that in the future, there will be a different system. Also, this is a new space. And given that it's new, we will see a lot of bumps in the road. And we will continue to actually see that. With decentralized finance, it is very anti-fragile. So you can disrupt it, and then it just improves. And I think that that's kind of a unique aspect of this particular space, especially given that everything is open source. You can just take the code, you can improve upon it, and relaunch very quickly. Right. So I think that all of this is important, and I would not be wed to the same sort of regulatory approach. I think that this is kind of temporary. So I said, well, maybe we need like 3 or 4 years to develop this safe harbor. But eventually, it just gets out of control. Indeed, I believe that even the central banks have lost control over money, because with tokenization, there's just different ways to store value and to use value in transactions.
Right. On that note, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on, Professor Campbell. I look forward to speaking to you again soon. If people want to find out more about you or your research, where's the best place for them to go?
Well, you can just Google and my name, Campbell Harvey. You'll see my homepage. And maybe you'll put a link to my book. And actually, I've got a 4-module Coursera.
Oh, cool.
Which is a certificate in decentralized finance. There's 4 separate parts to it. And I worked really hard on it, especially the quizzes. So a lot of times when you do these Courseras, you click just randomly like an answer. But you get actually an explanation as to why the answer is right or wrong.
Nice.
So I think it's a good learning experience. And it's done very well in terms of it.
Well, I would highly recommend that. I think, you know, your book, DeFi and the Future of Finance, even has a foreword by Vitalik. Clearly sort of very well researched, and I would recommend it to any of our listeners as well. So thank you again, and speak to you soon.
Thank you. You better call on these guys. I'm going radical, I'm going radish, I'm going radical, I'm going radish. Hyperspeed DeFi, never on a decline. Building the future, I feel like a savage.